I would begin, you know, not, it would be a real shame not to show you the real thing. So we are talking about ordering of spins in the Ising model. And so here's what we are talking about. So if you look at these simulations here, then for temperatures which are much greater than the critical temperature, you see basically the spins are randomly ordered. And so the average magnetization is equal to zero because you have basically all the time you have the same number of spins up as the same number of spins down. But of course each spin fluctuates. So this configuration is not fixed and it fluctuates in time. And so the spins keep flipping up and flipping down, but in average you still have the magnetization equal to zero. So now as you start approaching the critical temperature in the middle picture, then the spins start ordering into some bigger blocks. And so basically at critical temperature, the size of these blocks, let's say the white blocks, actually becomes larger and larger, and at T critical is actually sort of infinite or of the size of the system if you have a finite system. So you have this beautiful configuration of ordered spins. And of course, the average magnetization is still equal to zero because you have the same number of the spins up and the same number of spins down. But now these are ordered in these huge blocks. And so what is actually very interesting about this picture is that if you zoom in or zoom out, it doesn't really matter. So you still see the same type of configuration. So in other words, this picture here has a fractal structure. It is scale independent. So if I zoom in, I still see the same thing. If I zoom out, I still see the same thing. Similar to the first fractal observed by the coast of England or whatever. So people are thinking, you know, if they zoom on the coast of England, they will find something different. But no, it still looks the same no matter which scale I'm looking at it. So the same thing happens here. And so this fractal structure at critical point, or this, you know, scale invariance is very, very crucial for describing the critical point, and as we will see later. So just remember at T critical, you have scale invariant picture and fractal structure of that. So now below T critical, of course, now the magnetization is not equal to zero. So let's say we have more spins up, which are denoted here by the white blocks. So the white blobs are bigger now than the black ones. But you see, so, you know, starting of ordering the system. So now you have really big blocks of ordered spins, and you have big blocks of ordered spins in the other way around, and so on. Okay, so that's basically what's going on when we talk about a phase transition between the disordered phase and the ordered phase as the temperature changes. So this is what you should have in mind, and it will be a real shame not to show you this. So now there's an interesting other concept which we will discuss briefly next week, but not really, and it's that block spin renormalization group. And so basically the idea is, you know, when you start zooming out of the system, what do you see? So, or if you are actually, you know, merging the cells of the system. So let's say, well, here I have some original lattice, and then let's say I take four pieces of this lattice, four lattice points, and make one of that in the first step, and then in the next step again. So I'm actually zooming out of the system. You know, the system looks smaller and smaller. So, but if you are above the critical temperature, so this is what you see. So you see basically a disordered phase, no matter how far away you're looking at the picture. However, if you are below T critical, and so you are replacing, you know, these several spins by one spin, then of course you are sort of approaching the ordered phase. So whenever, you know, the black dots overwhelm, there's more black dots than the white blobs, I replace by black dot. If there is more white blobs, I replace by white blobs. So this is how this picture is obtained. And then this one here again, and this one here again. But you are sort of flowing to very nicely ordered phase. And so this will be used for, this is like real spin renormalization group. And we will briefly discuss that next week. And that's how the renormalization started, is basically you realize when you are zooming out of the system, you are, and if you are below t-critical, you are moving to the ordered phase. If you are not, then you know nothing interesting happens. Okay, so just you know these. So this picture at this point is more interesting and more for us. But I found this beautiful. Well, not really beautiful, but it's quite nice. Video on YouTube. So what happens? So you don't see it. It's interesting. Just a second. So I have to kill this thing probably. Okay. Now you see it. So this is the temperature. And so we start above the critical temperature, and so this is the below critical temperature. And so this is like a real simulation, what happens with the spins. So let me just run the video, and then there's a link to it on your thing. So this is as we keep decreasing, you know, the temperature slowly from above critical to below critical. And so you see how this ordering of spins sort of happens. So at the beginning we had really real disorder, and now you start forming, you know, these bigger and bigger blobs of spins, which are equally oriented. And so now as you really approach this critical temperature, the spins, the blocks of spins are getting bigger and bigger. And so in some sense, you could almost travel from one side to the other side, just going on the on the spins of the same alignment. And so that means you are at T critical. So now they are basically of the size of the system, but you see they still fluctuate, of course. And then below T critical, you know, this becomes more and more ordered, and you start slightly developing some small magnetization. So you can also see at the bottom here, it's nicely done. So the yellow thing here is the correlation of nearest neighbors. So basically the correlation of neighbors starts increasing, meaning you will find aligned spin to your spin as, you know, the temperature decreases. So your neighbor will be aligned as you are, more and more likely. Sorry?
M stays zero.
This is very strange. I don't understand that thing. So M should be rising slightly or lowering slightly, depending on, you know, which sign you choose.
I think it's probably because like they don't do it adiabatically, right? So you develop domains.
How do I run that again? Too late.
M will stay zero if you measure over the whole lattice. You still have probably.
If you do it at a finite rate.
Isn't it just going to take infinitely long time to actually go to a ground state? Because your size is infinite?
Yeah, you'd have to do it adiabatically to get the whole.
Isn't it locally non-zero?
To get the whole lattice to.
Locally non-zero.
Symmetry break.
Well,
I mean, in region.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, the magnetization is like an average, right? So you are not, yeah, it's an average. So anyway, so this is the picture of what really happens. And I think the magnetization should be developing, but I don't understand why it is not developing. But this is what really happens. So this is what I have in mind when we talk about ordering of the Ising, ordering of the Ising model. And so this is the YouTube video, and I gave you that link on this paper, so you can play with it on your own. Okay, so thank you so much. That's enough for you. Thanks. Very good. So, yeah.
For the block spin thing, if you did the RG procedure after T critical, would the picture just stay the same? Is that what would happen?
Yeah, well, you get a fractal structure, yes. So it doesn't matter which scale you are looking at.
Okay.
This. So you should get the same time of picture, yes.
Isn't that the definition of T critical? That it flows towards or away from that point? That RG, like,
yeah, that it stays on.
You have an RG flow function, right?
And so if you are exactly at T critical, you stay at T critical.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that the definition of T critical line?
Yeah, if you want, yeah. Okay, so what I would like to do now very briefly discuss is this, you know, how this ordering can be described, and that's described by spin-spin correlation function. So you define this. So if you have two lattice points I and j, then you basically take a variation of what you see there minus what is the average thing. And so you can write this as sigma I, sigma j minus sigma I, sigma j. Okay, and so this is what you mean by spin-spin correlation function, and we've seen that, you know, as you go below t critical, the correlations between spins are becoming more and more correlated, if you want, so they are aligned in the same way. So now the way how to calculate this in the mean field theory is to actually use a useful trick, and so you introduce a magnetic field, which is now position dependent. And so your Hamiltonian, so trick to calculate is to consider now the Hamiltonian, which is the thing which we want, ij and jij, sigma I, sigma j. But now you put this thing into a spatial varying magnetic field. So now, before we always had B equal to it was the same thing over the whole lattice, but now you allow this to be spatial dependent, so Bi, sigma I, sigma j. And so having this thing here, you can calculate this correlation function as the following formula. So this is your corresponding free energy, and you just differentiate that free energy twice with respect to these B fields and evaluate at B equal to zero. And so you can verify yourself that this formula indeed gives you something like this correlation function here. So basically each derivative with respect to B brings one sigma into your trace. And so if you differentiate twice, you get two sigma into your trace. And so then you have trace of rho sigma I sigma j, which is precisely what you call average sigma I sigma j. So this formula actually exactly does that. So now it would take at least one lecture to actually calculate this. And so I'm not going to do that. It's a painful calculation. And so I just give you the result here, I hope. And it's basically in any textbook, so if you are interested in this calculation, just find it in any textbook, but it's quite long, quite technical, and quite messy. And it uses some, you know, strange techniques, so let's not go into that. So if you did calculate it in the mean field theory approximation, what you find is this result here. So there's some...
And actually, this calculation is not that long.
Okay.
Can we explain quickly for quantum transition?
Okay. Well, every time I saw it, it was very long. so what you find is this thing here, and then Ri, Rj. We will sort of derive this thing when we have the renormalization group techniques in a nicer way. So we will basically derive the same result, but not in this way. Okay, and then this is 2 power d minus 2, where this psi is given as a square root of kappa over 2 t minus tc. Okay, so this is the result of that calculation, which I'm not going to do. So now what you observe is that this correlation function between sides I and j, which are of course separated by ri minus rj, so it falls off and it has two suppressing factors. One of them is 1 over the distance between the two sides to some dimensionality power, so it's 1 over r to d minus 2, and then there is an exponential factor, and so this exponential is weighted by this xi. The xi is called correlation length.
V is just spatial dimensions, right?
Sorry?
Spatial dimensions, V.
right? Or are we talking about space-time differential?
This must be... I don't know, what is it? I think it's spatial dimensions, isn't it? So if you are in two dimensions, you should have logarithm. So this doesn't work. And if you are in three dimensions, you get 1 over r. So d is the number of spatial dimensions. Yeah. OK. So xi is the correlation length. It basically tells you how much, you know, how quickly this exponential is decaying your correlations. And so what it basically describes is the sizes of the blocks of the ordered spins. So at, you expect that at t critical, the correlation length should go to infinity, because now the spins are correlated at the size of the system. Okay, and that's precisely what you see here, that the correlation length at t critical actually, you know, blows up. And so correlation length defines how big the blocks of spins are. Okay, so.
Concerning this two coefficient, what is
the kappa? Very good. Thanks for that. So, A is the Lattice spacing. So, it's the Lattice spacing if you have I and I plus 1, then this is A. T is temperature, and kappa is something which we see, which we shall see today later in the lecture, is spin stiffness. And I will basically tell you what it is in 20 minutes or so. So at this point, it's just some, you know, something which characterizes your system. But it's temperature independence. It's not interesting quantity at this point. So it's just something which is there. Okay, so this is what you would get if you did this mean field theory calculation. However, more generally, what you would find is that G of R is proportional to E to minus R over Xi, and then R D minus 2 plus eta. So this is the behavior of a correlation function more generally. So it only depends on the distance between two points. Where this correlation length behaves like t, this is t minus tc over tc, that thing is this power nu. Okay, so you notice that we introduced two new things. We introduced eta and we introduced nu, and these are two additional critical exponents which exist in statistical physics. So eta is called anomalous dimension, critical exponent. And nu, well, it's called correlation length critical exponent. Correlation length critical exponent. And so you see that this nu describes really how much, you know, the xi diverges as you approach the critical point. And this eta basically tells you how much wrong is your dimensional analysis. So you would expect from the dimensional analysis, of course, this is dimensionless. And so you would expect that your correlation function goes like 1 over r to d minus 2. And this would be just 0. So basically, this eta tells you, well, something is wrong with your dimensional analysis. Okay. So now if you compare this general thing with whatever is the prediction of the mean field theory, then you see that if I want to compare this expression with that expression, then you read that nu, so in mean field theory, you see that nu is equal to 1/2. And of course, mean field theory doesn't break the dimensional analysis, so eta actually equals to zero. There was a question, yeah?
This eta, is it defined below TC? Sorry, not Asia. I think I mean that.
This guy here.
No, I mean that.
Psi.
The correlation end.
Psi.
Psi. C.
Psi.
Psi. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very good. Very good. So it's in some sense it's defined. Both above and below correlation length. And so I have this picture, which I'll just draw in a minute. So basically, above the p-critical, it describes the size of the, you know, the of the blocks of spins which you want to put up. And below, it's exactly the size of the other spins in some sense. So if you look at this thing here, for the correlation length, you are sort of subtracting the background. You are taking away the correlation of the sigma I and sigma j spin. And then you are subtracting the average background as the other term, in some sense. So now if you are below TC, everything is more or less ordered, and so you are subtracting something non-trivial, and so you are effectively flipping what you are interested in what blocks you are interested in, whether the blocks up or blocks down in some sense. So yeah.
And is the definition the same? Because it looks like it would be complex.
Oh, very good. So here, you probably have to take an absolute value or something like that. Or maybe this one is just, this one might be correlated, calculated just above TC. Yeah, so, okay. Other questions?
Yeah, so you say that eta is, in a sense, how wrong you are in your dimensional analysis.
Uh-huh.
But in order to be wrong at all in dimensional analysis, you need another scale.
Well, that's right.
You need something dimensional.
But remember, what's happening with your ordering at t critical is that suddenly you have a fractal structure, right?
Yes.
So in some sense, your picture is not two-dimensional anymore, but it has a fractal dimension. The fractal dimension is different from your true dimension.
What do you mean by a fractal dimension?
Well, so if you have various fractals, you can assign what the corresponding dimension of the fractal is. And that's calculated, we can review that in tutorial if you want.
Yes.
but yeah, so basically your naive dimensional analysis, your naive dimensional thing of, you are living in two dimensions breaks down near critical point. Because you have now scale invariant theory, you have fractal thing. And so this eta, this anomalous dimension, is sort of related to this fractal dimension of the thing which happens.
Okay. But still, even if you can assign a physical picture to it, there's a dimension less, like there's something in the dimensions wrong, right? I mean, there's a proportionality constant there, and that proportionality constant is not a number. It has a dimension.
Yes, but we don't include the proportionality constants. There can just be...
I know, but okay, the question I want to ask is, if there's a dimension full constant there, that kind of tells you that there is some kind of a scale.
Yeah, yeah.
We're looking
at
critical points, which is usually a CFD, and which, by definition, has no scale.
Okay.
So, like, there seems to be something odd happening there.
I agree. So you can think, yeah, I agree with that. Well, I don't have better answer than what I have already said. Yeah.
Like I can if there's a constant there, I can derive a mass from that or something, right? Or length or whatever.
Do you have any good answer, Dennis, for this? Or
I mean, the real constant, the real constant, but it will.
Well, here, yes. Yeah, here, but you already said that.
Yeah, there is a constant, but the point is that we are considering the physics at very large distances.
Yes.
So, and presumably the constant the length of the dimension, but if you have microscopic scale,
Sorry, that will be subject to further discussion. So now let me just plot whatever we've seen before. So we've seen that at t equal to zero, all the spins are ordered, let's say, up, and your average magnetization is equal to one. So now if you are in temperatures which are smaller than Tc, then you have, most of the spins are up, but some of the spins are actually down. And you can think about the correlation length to measure the size of this, of these blobs which are actually down. So the average magnetization is still, you know, approximately one, but you, if the temperature is, you know, above zero, then you will always have some spins which are going down, and then you can think about psi, the correlation length, to be measuring the size of these spins. So now, if you are at T critical, then you have things which extend all the way to the size of the system. So these are spins up, and the other ones are spins down. So your average magnetization is basically equal to zero, but the correlation length, so this is T equal to Tc, but the correlation length goes to infinity, and we see this fractal structure. So now if you are above Tc, then you have this disordered phase, and you have only small islands of spins up and small islands of spins down. And so the correlation length will measure that. So here the correlation length is basically the size of the system, or psi goes to infinity. And so here this is for T bigger than Tc, bigger than Tc. So this is random configuration. And this one will be ordered phase. Okay. So now if you, to your question, if you plot this psi as it looks depending on the temperature, so this is my Tc, and so you'll find that this psi diverges in both sides. And behaves like T minus T. Okay, but it measures in some sense, you know, different things on, you know, below Tc, and it measures different things above Tc if you want. Okay, so that's the picture. What's happening about the correlation length actually, correlation function displays. So now we have the full set of critical exponents. We have alpha, beta, gamma, delta from yesterday, and then we have eta and nu. And so it's the prediction of mean field theory that those two are equal to there, and then alpha is equal to zero, beta 1/2, gamma 1, and delta 3. And so these are the critical exponents characteristic for your mean field theory. So now, to Nick's comment yesterday, so it seems that we have now six critical exponents, but it turns out that only two of them actually are independent, and there are some relations which connect these critical exponents, and so in most of the cases, only two actually are independent, and all the other follow from these various equations. So there are some relations which you will study in your tutorial on Thursday, and then typically only two are independent out of these six. And so the critical exponents in mean field theory satisfy these relations. So these relations are more general than mean field theory. So these relations are, you know, basically very, very general. And so based on these relations, you can always show that there should be like only two independent critical exponents. And so mean field theory critical exponents satisfy these relations, and only two are independent. Yes?
Why didn't we talk about the dynamical critical exponent?
Why didn't we talk about
the critical exponent Z? Like relaxation time, stuff like that? Is that like in a different class?
Well, we don't talk about dynamics here at all in some sense, so yeah. all that, yeah.
Is that, but like, do people not?
So here we are doing basically equilibrium statistical physics.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure if, you know, there are some relations relating that one to these. Probably there must be, but yeah. All right, so that's everything you need to know about correlation function. So now let me return back to that calculation which we done yesterday. You know, turning the Ising model to the field theory. Okay, so yesterday, we started discussing the partition function for the Ising model, and so we started from the standard expression. It's sum of the all possible spin configurations, E minus beta H. So it's 1 over 2t, and then sum over I and J, Jij, sigma I, sigma J. So this is your partition function. So now you use this multidimensional expression for your Gaussian thing. So now you use the Gaussian integral, 1 e to 1 half gamma I aij gamma j is equal to 1 over determinant of a, 1 over 2 pi and half, and then minus infinity to infinity. Now you have d phi 1 to d phi n, and then e to minus 1 half phi I aij minus 1 phi j plus gamma I phi I. So this is your Gaussian integral. And so you take this thing and use it for this to write an integral representation of your partition function. Okay, so if you do that, so you identify your aij to be jij over t, and then your gamma I to be sigma I. And so you immediately see that you have your z written as an integral over this thing. Now you will have jij to minus 1, and then this term there, sigma I phi I. And then you can also rescale your phi I's to phi I over t. And so if you do that, you find that there is some prefactor which is not interesting. But you have now an expression sigma I minus infinity to infinity, now saying that that prefactor was absorbed or set equal to 1. I just change my d phi vector to big d phi vector. And then e to minus 2t phi I jij minus 1 phi j, and then plus 1 over t sigma I phi I. Okay, so this is what I shown you yesterday, that you have now this nice expression for the partition function, seemingly more complicated than we started with, but it's not true, because now we can actually do this sum over sigma I, because sigma I only appears linearly here. And so you can do that sum here. But notice also that, you know, these are the sigma I's, they describe our spins. And so now they interact with other spins only through this field phi I. Okay, so before, in the mean field theory approximation, they interacted with each other through the mean field M. So there was this term M times sigma I. So now you have something a little bit more complicated. You have phi I times sigma I. So you are replacing your M with some field which is allowed to fluctuate throughout your lattice. Okay, so this is the thing. And so if you do this sum, and that's very simple, it just gives you cosine h, you find a very nice expression for z, and it looks like a functional integral, which you will be discussing in your field theory. And so this is stated by some action which depends on your field phi. where this action is given by 1 over 2t phi I jij minus 1 phi j, and then minus sum over I, and then logarithm of 2 times cosine h phi I over t, and then there's this thing here as well. Okay, so this is your expression for the partition function now. It looks very much like field theory, but it's not field theory because our fields phi I, they still live on the lattice. So what we will do now is a continuum limit to this thing so that, you know, tricks doing field theory, well, yeah, it's easier to deal with continuum than with actual lattice things. And in some sense, it doesn't really matter for the critical point because the lattice is not important for the critical point. You have these huge correlations over the whole system, so lattice cannot be important for that, okay? So that's our expression. And so you can think about this phi I approximately as this magnetization, average magnetization, which we used in the mean field theory. Okay, but now you allow this to vary from place to place if you want. Questions? So this is the setup. So now let us do this painful calculation. By the way, there is a sum over I and J, which I don't write, because, but it's the same index appearing twice. So you are summing over I and J in the first term. Okay. So to proceed further, you have S is 1 over 2T, and then phi I, jij, minus 1, phi j. And then you know, because phi behaves like magnetization, basically, and it was the mean field theory prediction, you got like a saddle point approximation of this thing. So it must be small, close to the critical point. So you can basically expand this logarithm treating phi as a small quantity. So your Taylor expand this. And so if you do that, you have plus, is there a minus? Just a second. Yeah, there's a minus. So minus logarithm of 2, and then minus 1 half phi I over t square, and then plus 1 over 12 phi I over t to the 4, and so on. So you are doing the Taylor expansion, treating phi as small quantity on that logarithm here. Okay. So now you'll have to do some work, especially on the first term, on this term here. So by the way, this is just a constant, and so it doesn't matter. So you just, you know, drop that, and you don't care about it anymore. Okay. So Let's work on this term first. And in order to do that, I'll have to tell you a little bit about Fourier transform.
There's still a sum over I, right? Or does
it disappear? Oh, there's still sum over I, yes.
Okay.
Thanks. Still sum over I here. Okay, so what is Lattice Fourier transform? Okay, so basically you do like a Fourier transformation, but now on a lattice where you have, you know, sides, and then so your things are defined on the lattice points. But of course your momentum, if you have lattice, your momentum also will be quantized. So you don't have like a continuum thing, but you have only sums. So in other words, phi I, which is phi at the position I, if you want to transfer them to the momentum space, it'll be given by sum over the momentum q, and then phi of q, and then e to I k times ri. Okay, so this is how you transform your phi from position to a momentum space. So now you can, it's a great advantage that your lattice is uniform and that really the interaction what matters is the distance between two points in the lattice. It's not the direction or whatever, but it's just the distance. So for this reason, you can transform these Jij things, which appear in your Hamiltonian, as 1 over n, sum over q, j of q, and then e to I q ri minus rj. Okay, so it depends only on the distance on the vector which connects these two sides. Okay, so this is how we do the Fourier transform. So now we will need two properties of this Fourier transform. It's basically how to get the Dirac delta function out of them. And so the properties of the Fourier transform is that 1 over n, and if you sum over all lattice points, and e k minus k prime, and then ri. So you have two different momenta, and this is my same position ri here. And so you get that this is equal to delta k k prime. So that's one property, it's orthonormality if you want. And the other property, of course, is in the other space, so 1 over n, and now you sum over q, and then e minus iq ri minus rj, and that gives you just delta ij. So it's only non-trivial if you are at the same I and j. So these are the two properties, if you want orthonormality properties or of the lattice Fourier transform. Okay, so let's use these to actually calculate what this phi I j I j minus 1 phi j is. Okay, so we have, so now really we have sum over I j, let's write it explicitly now, phi I j I j minus 1 phi j. So that's the term, the first term which we have to deal with. And so you have to Fourier expand everything here. Okay, so expanding the phi I, you get, well, okay, so it's still sum over I and j. And then phi I gives you 1 over n, sum over q. Phi q e to I q ri. Okay, so that's what phi I is. Then this guy here is 1 over n sum over q prime using this formula. So it's j minus 1 q prime, and then e to I q prime times ri minus rj using this formula here. So that's jij to minus 1. And finally, phi j is 1 over n sum over q double prime, and then phi q double prime e to q double prime times rj. Okay, so we transform every quantity into the momentum space. So why we are doing this is, of course, we have this sum over I and j, and we somehow want to use the orthonormality relations. So now performing the sum, let's say, over I, So we'll have a term sum over I, and then if you look at the things which depend only on I, it's this exponential here, and it's this part of the exponential here, right? So nothing else depends on Ri or on I, okay? I don't mean the imaginary I here. So anyway, so now you have that sum over I of this exponential, and if you precisely look at this thing here, so if you take 1 over n factor, it tells you just, it gives you delta q and minus q prime, okay? So the sum over I just gives you delta q and q prime, and one of them is minus thing, right? So now if you look at equally at a sum over j, so the only thing which depends on j is the second part of this exponential, and then this guy here. And if you use the same formula, you will see that it gives you delta q prime and q double prime. So sum over j gives you delta q prime and q double prime. Okay, so now everything drastically simplifies. So what it gives us, so one of them has plus and one of them has minus because, yeah. So by the way, if you are not interested in how to take continuum limit, you can switch off here and just, you know, remember the result. I just thought this is, you know, let's do it once and forever and forget about it. And then from then later on, you can just always write down the result. So anyway, so doing the sum over I and J, you end up with 1 over, so this is equal to 1 over N, sum over, so now Q, Q prime, and Q double prime is still there. And then we killed 2 times 1 over n, so 1 over n is not there anymore. And then we have this delta q and q prime with minus sign, and delta q prime and q double prime here, and phi of q, and then g minus 1 q prime, and phi of q double prime, okay? So now we have those 3 sums, yes?
Do the Dirac deltas have coefficients, like n?
Well, so here I define it in this way.
Okay,
yeah.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah, that is 101 different conventions for Fourier transform. So let's just use this one here. Okay. So we have that. Of course, now these deltas, each of them kills one of the sums. So in the end, I will have just one sum. And so there's no surprise. Then the result actually gives you 1 over n, sum over q, and then I have phi of q, and then q prime is minus q, so j minus 1 is minus q, and then phi q double prime is q prime, which is minus q, so phi of minus q. Or if I want to follow whatever I have in my notes, I can change everywhere q to minus q. Because you are summing all over all possible q's, that's possible. So this is 1 over n, sum over q phi minus q, j minus 1, q phi q. Okay? So this is what that first term actually is in the moment space. Very good. So in order to proceed further, you need to know what this j minus 1 of q is, okay? And so by definition, basically, it's a Fourier transform of this jij term, jij minus 1 term. So it's given over here, okay? So need to know j of q. And So of course, in, you know, in general, this will be a complicated thing. But what we really want to do is we want to study the vicinity of the critical point. In the vicinity of the critical point, we have almost a fractal structure. So we have scale invariant theory. Okay, so it doesn't matter how much we zoom out of the system, you still see the same thing. So we will be describing now this critical point from very, very far away for large scales. But large scales, of course, mean small momentum. Okay, so critical point corresponds to, you know, large scale physics, if you want, which of course corresponds to small momenta. Okay, so that means all we need to know is how this thing looks, or we can do Taylor expansion where we treat Q as a small quantity. Okay. And so what you are effectively saying here is really, yeah, if I concentrate on large scales, I really don't need to know about the lattice. The lattice, you know, becomes, yeah, you can neglect the function of the lattice, and that's the continuum that we are taking here. Okay? And we can take it because we are interested in the vicinity of the critical point.
What do you mean by large scales if you have scale invariance, right? Large compared to what?
Well, it means I can really zoom out of the system and, you know, forget about lattice. I can concentrate on scales which are much larger than lattice spacing. That's what I mean by that.
Are you talking about the scale of the interaction, or I have difficulties?
Oh, that's good. That's good. It will become clear in a moment.
Okay.
Just wait one line. Okay. So that's a very good question. Just remember that question and see if I answer that. So JQ is by definition 1 over n. Sum over I and J, J I J, e to minus I Q, R I minus R J. So that's the inverse of the definition of J Q up there. Okay, and so now I'm saying I can concentrate on small momenta. So this guy, you know, I can do a Taylor expansion for small Q. Okay, so what is this equal to? So it's 1 over n, sum over I and j, jij. And then you do the Taylor expansion on the exponential. So the first term is just 1, minus iq ri minus rj. And so you might think this is good enough, but I'll tell you it's not. And so actually you have to add one more term, which is minus 1/2, and then Q times Ri minus Rj and square. Okay. So this is your Taylor expansion. So of course 1 is not good enough. You need to have some non-trivial dependence on Q, because if you didn't, you would be basically back to mean field theory. So you have to go beyond that. So now if you look at the next term, this one term here. So remember that Jij describes the interaction between the spin I and J. But of course this interaction, the strength of the interaction must be the same as Jji. So there's a symmetry between I and J. So this guy is symmetric in I and J, but if this guy has a minus in between I and J. So this is antisymmetric. So now the most important formula in relativity, symmetric times antisymmetric equals to 0. Okay, so the second term actually doesn't contribute just based on symmetric arguments. Okay, so this term is not there, and that's why it's not enough to include that guy. Okay, so really it's the second term which is interesting. And then I will not really calculate it. I'll just motivate the result. So based on dimensional things, okay. So you see that there is something like Q square and then Ri minus Rj. And it's precisely the range of the interactions. So this thing here behaves like Q square. And it behaves like Ri minus Rj, which you can think is like a range of the interaction R square. Okay. And okay, so I'll write some formula here. So I'll say that, okay. So this is equal to 1 over n, sum over I and j, j I j, and then the other term is minus 1 over 2n, and then sum over I and j, j I j, and then this thing here, q r I minus r j square. So this is what we have approximately. So now the first term, so remember that if you take sum over one of these things, so you take, let's say, sum over I of jij, then this is what we define to be j. And so now you are summing now over j of j, so this is sum over j of j, which of course is n times j. So the first term just gives you n times j divided by n, so it just gives you j as we knew it. And so we are back to mean field theory, okay? So now the other term is this thing here, and I'll just write down what it is. So it has distance, the range of interactions to square, basically, it has Q square, and then you can do the same trick to this thing, so it is J times N, exactly as we done here, and then sometimes people put here D to get a better estimate what this is, where D is the number of spatial dimensions. So anyway, so this thing here, and they still minus 1 over 2n, okay? Okay, so that was too fast. So n cancels, this n cancels that n. And so this thing here, jr square over d, is precisely what people call the spin stiffness. So it's, you know, given by how much the spins interact times the typical range of the interactions, which of course is of the order of lattice spacing. So the range of the interaction for, you know, two spins, nearby spins, typically, you know, is of the order of A of the lattice spacing. Okay. And so people call this quantity here, J times R square over D, they call it spin stiffness. Basically, you know, how difficult it is to base the spin, if you want. Yes?
Stan, can you repeat again why you put a D in?
Why you put D?
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't really matter. You can put D or not, doesn't really matter. So people put D. But you know, I haven't told you what this R is anyway. So, yeah, so it's something which is independent of Q. That's what matters. So in the end, what you have is that this thing equals to J, and then minus 1/2, and then you put everything which you actually don't have to deal with, or you don't want to deal with, into this kappa, and then Q square. Okay, and that's the first correction for small form momenta. For your j of q. So if you just took the first term, you would have a constant j, which would be the mean field, but now we want the first correction to be there. And this is actually an interesting correction, which will give rise to, yeah?
You said, like, I'm not going to do the calculation, I'm just going to do dimensional analysis.
Yeah.
So there is a calculation.
Well, this is basically dimensional analysis, right? You see J, you put J, you see R, you put R, and you see Q, you put Q.
Yeah, so this is dimensional analysis, but you said, I'm not going to do the calculation.
Okay.
So is there a calculation? I mean, is what? There a... a more rigid way of doing this?
I haven't seen it, but I'm sure there is.
you know, big R does not depend on qubit.
Well, if it did, then it would be a high order in your expansion. So I can take, you know, what happens at q equal to zero, and then, you know, that would be a higher order term, which I'm neglecting here because I treat q as small. Yeah, well, that's why, you know, I haven't told you what R is, and it doesn't matter what it is. So it's important that this is something times q squared. Okay, very good. So this was the hard calculation to be done, you know.
Wait.
Yes?
I'm quite convinced about R. I'm not sure whether you're going to say something more about it, which will make it clear, but at the moment we have a difference between Ri and Rj, and we sum over all pairs of lattice sides through the lattice, and then we simply say that this is a constant, just by taking the average distance, or how do we do this? Like, how can we approximate different quantities by just R?
By dimensional analysis.
If n is very, very big, can you use like central limit theorem kind of thing?
Maybe.
Because q is constant, right? For all I and j, q doesn't depend on I and j.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so you can bring that out. And then basically what you have there is like the mean, like the mean value of Ri minus Rj squared.
Yeah, yeah.
That looks like something that you can work on with like a central limit theorem.
Sounds good to me. Yeah,
thing.
Possible. Yeah, good. You can do it more precisely. very good. So anyway, so we have this thing here. Okay. So very good. So let's use this, right? So we know. Well, I put it a stupid thing to do. So we know that this term, where is it? Sum over phi I j I minus 1 phi j equals to that, where this j minus 1 of q is given here. Okay, so let's use it. So let's take the first two terms in this expansion here, and let's call it S0. Okay, so let's call this S0. And so you can write it as 1 over 2t square, and then sum over I and j, t phi I, j I j minus 1, phi j. So that's the first term. And then the second term is minus sum over I, phi I square. Okay, so this is what it is. So now we use that result for Jij, for what we calculated for this thing here. So this is equal to 1 over 2t squared n, and then sum over q, phi of minus q. And then, yeah, I'll just write it down. So we still have that t there, j of q minus 1 phi of q. Okay, so the second term is just phi square, which is this thing here written in momentum space. And the first term is whatever we calculated over there. Okay, so far we are happy. So now we use that expression for j of q. Okay, so this thing here is t over, and so it's j of q is this thing, so it's j minus this thing here. So it's j minus 1 half kappa q square minus 1, which is, so now I treat this as a small thing, so I'll put it in the denominator using the Taylor series. So you have t over j minus 1, and then you have plus 1 half kappa q square over j. Okay. So now what I remember, we called j tc. Okay, so this is precisely the same j, this constant j here, this constant j here, is just what we previously called tc in the mean field thing. So what you are getting there is t over tc minus 1, which is precisely small t. So you get that the middle term here is given by t plus some q square correction here. So this is equal to t plus, and then now if I plug in what I mean by kappa, then r square q square doesn't really matter, 2d, and that's it. So now the last thing to do here is to absorb some unwanted things into your phis. So basically what you want to get is something which is like phi and then q square and phi again, but you are getting this clutter here. So you want to absorb that into your phi. So you do phi goes to tc square root of 2d over r a d over 2, and you denote a new thing r to be 2d this small t divided by r square. Okay, so this is important formula. This is not so important. And so you arrive at a beautiful result if you do these substitutions, is that this s0 actually, so this s0 is equal to 1 over 2, 1 over n a to d, sum over q, phi minus q, and then r plus q square phi of q. Okay, so that's your result here. So try to do all, you know, the substitutions if you want. That's really, it kills all the terms. Okay, so now this was still on a lattice where you treat q to be discrete. But of course, you can do the continuum limit, and you can equally write this as 1 half in the continuum limit as an integral now, d dq over q pi d, and then phi of q. Phi of q. Okay, I just change this sum into an integral, and this is your measure for your integral to be well defined. Okay, or you can write it in the so this is in momentum space, but you can also write it in the position space. And so this is your formula. It's 1 half d dx of, and now so r is there, that's fine. So it's r phi square, and then if you have q square phi and phi, you probably recognize you from your field theory course, and this is just the gradient of phi square, so plus gradient of phi square. Okay, so isn't this beautiful? So we found that this s is given by this s0 plus this phi 4 correction. However, this S0 is nothing else, so S0 is nothing else than the action for massive scalar field so you are getting massive Klein-Gordon theory if you want now. However, there is no time here. So this is in imaginary time. So everything here is, you know, spatial dimensions. There is no time whatsoever. So in imaginary time, and so now you can, hey, hallelujah, you can connect everything we are going to do here is whatever you are doing in your field theory course now at the moment, right? Okay, so finally, there was this interaction term, phi to the four term. So we dealt with the first term, we thrown away logarithm of two, we dealt with the second term, so finally there is this phi four term, but that's simple. So you call it as interacting, and you just say it's 1 over 12 t to the four, and then sum over phi I four. So that's your interacting term. And then, of course, you have to do the same definition of the fields as above. AD sum over I phi I 4. Now this becomes your integral over the space. And so in the end, it's no surprise, you can just write this as an integral d dx of phi to the 4. And then you put everything, you introduce a new constant u where you put all the clutter which you don't want. So phi to the 4, and where you call this thing u over 4 factorial. Okay, so this term is easy, and you know, it looks like phi to the 4, and it is phi to the 4, and everything what it would prevent you to call it phi to the 4, you put it into this u, which is the coupling constant now here. Okay, so the big result. So the big result, your total S is of course this S0 plus S interacting, which you can write as ddx of 1/2 lambda phi square, and then plus R over 2 phi square plus u over 4 factorial phi to the 4. And so this is your action, which is the original action, but now in the continuum limit. And so we are getting phi to the 4 theory for the scalar field. OK?
David, I have a question. So if you did the quantum version of this with the
Dennis will do. Dennis will do quantum version of this, right? Yeah.
But like because phi is like m, does that mean the particles in this theory would be like spin excitations or just like rock?
Particles.
Or what are the particles in the quantum theory?
Well, we are not going to discuss quantum theory, and Dennis will. So is it true?
Isn't it just an analogy instead of actually a description of like the same physical thing? Isn't it just say, look, the math is the same?
Yeah, sure, if you want. Yes. No, but this is a classical field theory, right? So we derive some classical field theory here.
It's two different physical things.
So that describes the phase transition that is purely classical.
Okay, so let me continue, and maybe you will see, and you can have all these questions to Dennis next week. So, not to me, that's good. So this is the result. And so now if you switched off your attention, so now switch on again. So this is the most crucial result here. So you replaced your phi I's with the field phi, which is now defined everywhere, so it's really a field. It's a continuum field. So what is obvious from the derivation is that this constant u, well, is positive. So u is positive. And also, this constant r is proportional to t. It's proportional to t. Okay? So, of course, t is t minus tc over tc. So this can actually change sign. So this is another way. Important result which follows from the derivation. So the sign of this r, so this r has to do something with whether I am above critical temperature or below it, and this u has to be positive. That comes from the derivation, if you want. This functional is called Landau-Ginzburg functional. Landau-Ginzburg functional. And if you look at it, knowing what you have done in your yesterday's tutorial, So it basically looks like lambda of energy. So if I didn't have the integral over ddx here, and if I didn't have this gradient phi thing, so this would be precisely your Landau's energy, which we discussed yesterday, would have something which has to do with your order parameter m square, and that something was proportional to small t. And then you had something which was proportional to m4, or eta 4. And so this part of this is basically Landau. And what Ginzburg did, and he said, well, now I can allow spatial fluctuations to this. And so he added this term here. So it's an improved Landau's theory, where you can now allow the fluctuations of the field here. Okay. So you can use now the way of constructing these things without going through this painful continuum limit, in the same way as you dealt with the Landau's theory. Basically, you start with the Hamiltonian, and you see this Hamiltonian has certain symmetry. And so you can immediately write down what your Landau-Ginzburg functional is. You respect the symmetry, so I cannot write phi cube term. I can only write phi square, or phi to the 4, or phi to the 6, and so on. And then you allow for fluctuations, that's your prescription. And so you have immediately your Landau-Ginzburg functional, starting from the microscopic theory, without going through all this pain. Okay, so you can apply everything you know about Landau's functional here. So really this, you know, phi to minus phi symmetry corresponds to the symmetry sigma I to minus sigma I of Ising. And so you can immediately write it down here. So now you might be interested in, so we cut our expansion, well, somewhere here. So we had the logarithm over there, and so we did the Taylor expansion over for small phi, and then we arrive in this first line here, and we cut, so we went to phi to the 4 thing, and then we, you know, neglected all the other terms. So in principle, you can include them, but it doesn't change anything you need to know about your critical point. So it can be shown that, depending on the dimension, of course, that the higher order terms, like phi to the 6, phi to the 8, and so on, they actually don't matter. And so they don't tell you anything new. They are irrelevant for your physics. Similarly, you may be interested in, you know, what if I put more nablas here? What if I put nabla square on phi, the whole thing square, or something like that? Again, these things do not matter, and they are irrelevant terms. And this can be done by dimensional analysis, so let me maybe do, finally, the dimensional analysis of this thing, unless you have questions. Questions? So dimensional analysis is just 3 minutes thing. Dimensional analysis. Basically justifying what I just told you. So in relativity, you were using units of length. So in particle physics, people usually use units of energy. Unfortunately, they are precisely one over the other. So I'm always confused. So anyway, so what you say that the units of the momentum, and you assign plus one to units of the momentum, so units of energy or momentum or whatever, you count that as plus one. And so the position, well, the length, will have now units minus one. Okay, so which is precisely the opposite than you do in relativity. So in relativity, you measure everything in lengths. So you assign plus one to length and then minus one to momentum, but doesn't matter. Okay, so now, of course, our partition function is a functional integral of e to minus s. So there's an exponential of minus s. So s has to be dimensionless in our units. So the units of s is equal to zero. The units of the action is equal to zero. So now this is the units of dd of x plus the units, let's say, if you look at the first term of nabla square, plus the units of phi square. Okay. So now this has minus d. This has, it's 1 over length square, so it's plus 2. And so from here, you find that the units of the field is d minus 2 over 2. So that's the units of your field here. And so we just compared the first term here. So for our dimension analysis, we said dimensions are 0 here. It's dimensions plus this, plus dimensions plus that, plus dimensions plus that. Now you can look at the second term. And again, it will be dimensions of that, plus dimensions of r, plus dimensions of phi square. But you know what the dimensions of this thing is, and you know what the dimensions of phi square is, just d minus 2. So you can determine what the dimensions of r are. And so you find dimension of r is 2. And similarly, you can find the dimension of u, the last term, the dimension of u is epsilon, which is 4 minus d. Okay, so that's the dimensional analysis of your coupling constants. So you see that if you are in dimensions less than 4, u has positive dimension and r has positive dimension. And positive dimension is good. It means it's relevant. So by definition, you say, so these are coupling constants, if you want. So they are something which stands in front of your field. So you say a definition, you say that the coupling constant G is relevant when the dimension of G is bigger than 0, then you say it's irrelevant if it's smaller than 0, and then if it's exactly equal to 0, you say it's marginal. Okay, so that's classification of the coupling constants. So now we see that R has dimensions 2, so it's relevant. And then U will be relevant if the dimension is, well, if the dimension is smaller than 4, and it will be marginal in 4 dimensions. So for example, here you would have U in d equal to 4 spatial dimensions, but otherwise, if you are in small dimensions, you would be here. Okay?
Actually, you're relevant when u is greater than
4. Marginal. Yeah. Thanks, Dennis. So, what I mean here, u is relevant, is marginal if d equals to 4. That's what I meant. Sorry for that. Okay, and so you can now do your dimensional analysis yourself, and you can try to add some other terms here So for example, you may add some W term phi to the 6, which is of course allowed by your symmetry. But if you do that, you'll find that this W will actually, the dimension of W will be smaller than 0. So it will be irrelevant. And so it doesn't matter. So by doing this dimensional analysis, you can immediately find out, you know, do I need to include that term or not? And so I will show you why this irrelevant and relevant thing later on. So where does it come from? But that really, you know, you can decide immediately based on whether the dimension is plus, well, bigger than 0 or smaller than 0. You can immediately decide, I need it in my functional or I don't need it in my functional. Question?
Oh. So that statement that phi to the 6 is irrelevant is dimension dependent. Right?
Yeah. So all these things are dimension dependent because, because you have this d to the d of x thing, which is of course dimension dependent, and it decides, you know, what are the dimensions of other things. Yeah, that's right. Other questions? Okay, let me stop here, and we will start the normalization tomorrow. Exciting things.